You're listening to the Inverse Podcast, where we explore how the scriptures can turn our world upside down,
or how it can be weaponized to uphold the status quo. I'm Drew Hart.
And I'm Jared McKenna, and this is Inverse.
Hey friends, we've got a great episode for you today. We've got here with us Mick Sheldrick, who is a policy entrepreneur and a driving force behind the efforts of Global Citizen to end extreme poverty. As a co-founder and chief policy impact and government affairs officer, he leads the organization's campaigns to mobilize support from governments, business, and foundations. He's the author of the Amazon best-selling book, From Ideas to Impact, a playbook for influencing and implementing change in a divided world. Michael has co-produced some of the world's most impactful social campaigns and events, including the annual Global Citizen Festival in New York and the Guinness World Record-winning virtual concert One World Together at Home. These initiatives have helped secure over $40 billion in support for essential resources such as healthcare, education, and climate resilience. With a career that spans the world of pop and policy, Michael has worked with international artists like Beyoncé, Lady Gaga, and Rihanna, as well as political leaders such as the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and former UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He has shared his insights on policy advocacy, sustainable development, and corporate responsibility at conferences and summits worldwide, and his work has been featured in leading outlets including Forbes and The Guardian. Mick serves on several boards, including the Ban Ki-moon Center for Global Citizens and the Steering Committee of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. Mick, we're really grateful to have you here on Inverse Podcast. Welcome.
No, thank you, Drew. It's a pleasure to be on, and it's great to see you again, Jared, this side of the world, but looking forward to the conversation.
Well, Mick, because your achievements are so long, we're actually out of time. But thanks for that. I'm just kidding. But I want people to pay attention that that was actually billion with a B. That's some serious impact. And I'm excited about your new book and congratulations on it doing so well. I know you're off to Spain next week, right, for the book tour there. Right. I would love to give you an opportunity to sketch a little bit of the learnings and the lessons, the mistakes and the tweaks that has led to that kind of impact that you're inviting others into at this time. Would you sketch a little bit this little gift that you've given to the world?
Yeah, thanks, Jared, for the opportunity to share. You know, Global Citizen is a huge organization now, even though we kind of started and you were with us along that early journey. We kind of started as student volunteers when I was studying in Perth at UWA there. And since then, you know, we've gone on, as you said, we've mobilized millions of citizens to take action. We've helped distribute billions of dollars and impact lives, which is fantastic. And I'm really proud of what we've done. However, you know, one of the things that, you know, kind of didn't sit right with me is I would often get people reaching out to me over Instagram, LinkedIn, almost asking every single time how they can start their own organizations, right? How they can do the same thing. And I didn't want people to think that they needed to go out, mobilize and run a huge organization in order to make a difference, right? Mm. Because I felt that that could be a big leap and that could actually be quite disempowering. And it's actually the opposite of what we believe that Global Citizen is in the power of the individual. So really the book was an attempt to really reorientate the conversation and to give people a place to begin. You know, in some ways, Jared and Drew, getting that question, like, you know, reminded me in some ways, and I promise this will make sense. It reminded me, you know, of being a high school student first year. And as we know, Jared, in Australia, we love our sporting heroes, our sporting icons. We put them on a pedestal. And, you know, which is great if you're really good at sport. If you're like me, that's terrible at sport, which I know is blasphemy in Australian terms. It was really hard, right? And this memory that these questions asking for advice from me would always trigger was this one in particular episode where I remember going on the oval, right, which we have in Australia, which we play a game, Australian football rules. And I always remember going on and being sat there going to kick this ball, right? And most kids our age or 13-year-old boys would just be thinking, I want to score a goal. I want to score a goal. And I remember sat there going, please God, please God, I just want to kick the goal and have it go in the right direction. I don't care about scoring a goal. I would be completely happy if I kick this ball and it just goes unnoticed, like an ordinary kick of the ball, right? Or kick of the goal at the goals. And sure enough, because I'd be overthinking it, I would kick this ball. It would fly off behind me or something weird would happen. All the other kids would laugh. And then I would go into a school assembly and the motivational speaker was always without fail, some Olympian gold medalist, right? Or, you know, a Brownlow.
Or an Eagles player.
Yeah, yeah. Or an Eagle with her own dodgy history sometimes.
That's right.
Exactly. We'd be putting them up as a beacon of moral good standing. And the reason why I share that story is because I remember sat in the audience thinking, well, it's all great. You've achieved all these things. I cannot relate to this in any way. And I was very conscious now, you know, more than a decade after creating Global Citizen, if I was given an advice, I wanted to be able to do it, present it in a way that could relate to people, right? And anyone, you know, yes, you can be a cultural icon like Taylor Swift, you can be a business leader, but also for the everyday citizen that may not have a bunch of assets, a bunch of social networks. And so the book really outlines 8 steps that all of us can do, can use as a roadmap to start to create policy change. And why do I focus on policy change? Because there are many ways to make a difference, right? And, you know, you can donate to a charity, you can volunteer your time, you can maybe plant trees, you can, if you're in the US and other societies, you can register to vote. And you can also have conversations. Like I always say, don't negate the power of conversations, because in the US alone, I think only 8% of households even talk about climate change at any time of the year.
That's right.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, right? But rarely when you ask someone, you know, in your family or friend circles, how do you create change? Rarely does shift in policy, right? Or systemic change come to mind, right? And that's because it can seem very impenetrable. It can seem vague and abstract, or it can seem like it's a domain just for the powerful and the wealthy. And so really the book is an attempt to break that down and give people a way and say, no, actually we need everyone involved in creating policy change, because some of the systemic challenges we have, like climate change, like ending extreme poverty, no amount of charity gala night dinners or, you know, even if we all converted to riding our bikes to work, will address these systemic solutions, right? And so in the words of Eleanor Roosevelt, who co-wrote the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the best way to begin is to begin. And I really hope the book gives people a way to begin and chart their own stories of impact.
Mm. Yeah, that's really good, Mick. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate, it seems like in the book, I have not gotten to read it yet. I'm looking forward to reading it soon. The multi-pronged, just the advocacy, collaborative partnerships, mobilization at the grassroots level, like just so many different avenues that I think it's just a really holistic way that invites us all into this work. So anyway, I'm really grateful for your work and also your witness, everything that you're doing. It's really powerful and important work. I'm really curious, as we kind of shift a little bit, one of the things that we love to do is to invite all our guests, whether of faith or no faith, to start off grounding our time together with scripture. And I believe that you might have a little extra for us this time. So what do you have for us that you'd like to ground our time with together right now before we get into more conversation?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, there's a great passage which Jared and I was talking about ahead of this, which, you know, I was trying to convey, you know, the sentiment that I was interested in, and he kindly pointed me to Psalms 24:1, which says, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." So that's the passage I'd like to begin with.
Now, I'm biased because I love that passage. In part, I suggested it. So well chosen, Mick. But let
Great
others
job.
know on. Yeah, that's right. Let others know what came to mind for you, because you've met such extraordinary people that others merely listen to or watch on telly or vote for or don't vote for, as the case may be. And these are people that so many of whom you've met with, including a bunch of theologians. I remember you coming to listen to me. Was it at UWA? I was presenting at UWA, and I quoted Miroslav Volf, and
That's
you
right.
were like, "Oh yeah, he's a lovely guy." I got to, and I was like, "What?" And you were like, "Yeah, we spent time to. Was it in Singapore or Malaysia? You were
It's
together. I can't
Singapore.
remember now." And you're like, "Oh yeah, he's such a lovely guy. He's really amazing." But I mean, one of the theologians that you spent time with, some people might have heard of him, Pope Francis. And
Maybe they've
you've
heard of him,
chosen,
maybe.
yeah, he's kind of a heavy hitter for the largest part of the Christian church in the world. You've chosen an encyclical from him. I know he didn't get to read it because he wasn't well, because this is from December last year, if I'm
That's
not.
correct. It was at the COP28 climate talks in Dubai, the most recent UN climate talks that took place.
Which people can go back to our Instagram from the time where we were talking about everything that was going on while you were there on the ground, and follow our conversation there. But you'd like to lift up something that he wrote, hoped to present, but wasn't well enough, and so somebody read in his place, which I think is incredibly powerful, and extrapolates that verse we were talking about earlier. Do you want to read that now?
And I would say, working, with the Pope, the Vatican was really part of a broader effort I've always had, going back to even when we met Jared, the power of faith communities, to achieve this UN Sustainable Development Goals. Yeah, I've always believed that there's a powerful role for communities to play there. And if you remember at university, when we first met, I was very involved in efforts on campus around mobilizing interfaith communities, whether it was eradicating malaria and other diseases. And so the genesis of my interaction with the Vatican was actually during the pandemic, when we were trying to campaign around vaccine equity. So make sure that vaccines weren't just hoarded by rich countries, but they were actually available elsewhere. And it was the first time we received a message from the Pope, from the Vatican, and indeed other faith leaders around the world. One funny story on that, just since you mentioned him, was, we've dealt with presidents, we've dealt with members of the royal household, and usually when you're using their name or the messages, there's a lot of layers of approval. And I remember going back to the Vatican press corps and just asking if they might be open to putting this out on social, putting the Pope's message in support of our work around vaccine equity, on the website. I wake up the next day and they've superimposed, against the Global Citizen logo, an image of the Pope with both thumbs up, and they broadcast that out on all of their channels, and I think it was on the front page of the BBC website. So
That's so great.
it was pretty cool. But this passage, which I'm going to read out, the reason why it spoke to me, it was just as I was coming to the end of writing the book and the manuscript. And I think what he touched on in many ways summed up the essence of what I was grappling with when I was writing the book, and the barriers people face, or the traps people fall into when they're trying to create change. So without further ado, and you can read the entire script from the Pope, it's readily available online. But I go to particularly the last two paragraphs because I think they were particularly well written and very powerful. So without further ado, the Pope said, "Please let us move forward and not turn back. It is well known that various agreements and commitments have been poorly implemented due to the lack of suitable mechanisms for oversight, periodic review, and penalties in cases of non-compliance. Now is the time no longer to postpone, but to ensure, and not merely to talk about the welfare of your children, your citizens, your countries, and our world. You are responsible for crafting policies that can provide concrete and cohesive responses, and in this way demonstrate the nobility of your role and the dignity of the service that you carry out. In the end, the purpose of power is to serve. It is useless to cling to an authority that will one day be remembered for its inability to take action when it was urgent and necessary to do so. History will be grateful to you, as will the societies in which you live, which are sadly divided into fan bases between prophets of doom and indifferent bystanders, radical environmentalists and climate change deniers. It is useless to join the fray. In this case, as in the case of peace, it does not help to remedy the situation. The remedy is good politics. If an example of concreteness and cohesiveness comes from the top, this will benefit the base, where many people, especially the young, are already dedicated to caring for our common home. May the year 2024 mark this breakthrough. I like to think that a good omen can be found in an event that took place in 1224. In that year, Saint Francis composed his Canticle of the Creatures. By then, Francis was completely blind, and after a night of physical suffering, his spirits were elevated by a mystical experience. He then turned to praise the Most High for all those creatures that he could no longer see, but knew that they were his brothers and sisters, since they came forth from the same Father and were shared with other men and women. An inspired sense of fraternity thus led him to turn his pang into praise and his wariness into renewed commitment. Shortly thereafter, Francis added a stanza in which he praised God for those who forgive. He did this in order to settle successfully an unbecoming conflict between the civil authorities and the local bishop. I too, who bear the name Francis, with the heartfelt urgency of a prayer, want to leave you with this message. Let us leave behind our divisions and unite our forces. And with God's help, let us emerge from the dark night of wars and environmental devastation in order to turn our common future into the dawn of a new and radiant day. Thank you.
Oh, man, oh, man. Mick, that's really powerful, really powerful. And when we return to that, I would love to discuss, Drew and I were talking about your archetypes in your book that you put forward in terms of leadership, in terms of the visionary, the diplomat, and the implementer. And I'd love to talk about what you just shared from the Pope in light of these archetypes of great leadership that's needed in this moment. But before we do, we like to ask, when do you first remember encountering the Bible as a way of getting into your own story? Mick, I'm aware, because I'm your mate, that you've got a number of mates who are God botherers. Myself as a Christian, Akram as a Muslim. How do you identify, if you do? And when do you first remember encountering the Jewish and Christian sacred texts?
So I think these days the best way I would describe myself is maybe agnostic, you know, and I think that's been pretty common since you and I first met one another. I don't have the firmness of belief outright to reject something you don't know all the answers to. So I think that's probably why I'm not atheist. I also think, you know, when you study law long enough, you learn how to stand on the fence different arguments and see the arguments on all sides. But you know, I've always said, and I remember speaking to a group of Mormons in Utah and Salt Lake City, and actually it was actually Christian protesters protesting the Mormon church on the outside on the picket line, and I just thought I'd go up and have a chat. And I always remember just explaining, and he asked me what I believed, and I said, look, I know whether you look into the stars at night and whether we're here because of the pure random chance of the universe and, you know, our atoms spreading and it's just brought us together in this moment, or whether it's part of a divine plan. Either way, it sounds pretty humbling and awe-inspiring. And this one guy who had been, you know, talking about all of the bad stuff Mormons were doing, suddenly he threw down his Bible, took off his hat and started crying and saying,
wow,
that is one of the most beautiful things someone's put to me. And it was nice because in that moment we brought my Mormon friends and him together. But to your question of where I first met the Bible, I guess, or was introduced to it. So although I was born in Western Australia, like you, Jared, my mom is British, as you know. And so for a number of years, for a number of family reasons, in the 90s, we actually returned to the UK when my mum was born, and I did primary school there. And one thing that's interesting in the UK is even government schools, even if it's primary school, you know, in Australia, like America, we have separation of church and state. But in primary schools, it was all Church of England, right? Mm. And even our headmaster was the local vicar. You know, he had the collar. He would come in. And so my introduction to the Bible was every day for 15 minutes. We did assemblies, and it was very, very like traditional, very Church of England. You know, there was very traditional hymns. So that was my introduction to the Bible. And, you know, as a result, I remember it in a way, you know, my introduction to the Bible, I don't want to say it was selfish, but it was very much focused always on, and we've spoken about this before, the concept of personal salvation. But it was very much, I remember being, my thinking around it was, what do I need to do to get into heaven? Okay, I've lied here. Does this mean I'm not going to get into heaven? Or please God, I've done this bad thing. Like, don't let it be found out. So that very much shaped my thinking around it. But that is probably because our headmaster was a very, very angry, angry guy.
Well, I think there's so much of, so many streams, I should say, of Western Christianity that emphasize that kind of transactional aspect that, I mean, I think many people inherit that, right? Like, that's the message many people take away is, you know, what can I do to get to heaven? And they're not necessarily learning how to be a good neighbor and how to show up in the world and care for others.
Anything about witnessing heaven on earth, right?
That's right. Heaven on earth. That's right. So Mick, I'm really interested to hear a little bit about, you know, a little more about how you experienced, right, the Bible. Did you experience it as something that was liberating, as something oppressive, maybe as a mix of things? Was it healing? Was it harmful? People have all kinds of stories and experiences with the Bible, and I'm really curious to hear your story with that.
Look, I would say that it was probably a bit of an oppressive side to it. And that's only because, you know, I recall this one experience where we were singing some hymns, and I think we was all out of tune, and headmaster, he had his piano. But I just remember he would crash his hands down on the piano and then cancel recess, and we would all be there singing and we were all into tune, you know, and we were like, I don't know, seven or 8 years old, right? At the time. But look, I think as I grew older, and I think, you know, as I started to learn more and had a curiosity in the world, I would say, you know, the liberating aspect, you know, there was really two instances. I think one, you know, early on, I learned, I guess, more about the Bible, you know, and the stories around it, not necessarily through primary school and the hymns and the Bible readings, because it was always very selective, right? Even in our religious studies class, you know, I would say a lot of it was Christian-based fantasy, to be honest. I was like, just to be completely honest, I was like, in my first year at high school, I devoured all of the C.S. Lewis Chronicles of Narnia. And then, you know, I know there's a whole debate on that as well, but reading those stories kind of forced you to go back to the origins. Okay, well, what's this based on, right? And then I would say the second real opening for me was when I was in first couple of years at university, and when I started working a lot in developing countries and volunteering, getting involved in advocacy around issues of extreme poverty. You know, I was exposed, you know, people like Jared, but also, you know, if you remember Jared, our mutual friend, Bob Mitchell,
for a period
at World Vision, and then he went on to become the CEO of, I think it was Anglican Overseas Aid of Australia. You know, and him and I got to travel a lot to Timor-Leste in around 2007, 2008, and he introduced me to a book by Steve Chalk called Lost Message of Jesus, which I know in itself...
Great book.
It was great. I know it has its own controversy at the time. You only have to Google it to see all the debates. But that book really resonated with me. And I think what you were talking about before, Drew, the kingdom of heaven on earth and how do you build that, that was something which, regardless of whether I was Christian or not, was something which I could relate to. And I think, finally, it was also in 2007, you know, I remember being struck because it was the 200th anniversary of the abolition of the slave trade in the British Empire. And I learned a lot and devoured a lot about the efforts of William Wilberforce and many of the abolitionist campaigners, many of whom were motivated by their Christian faith. And so I think I was looking at that as inspiration for our own advocacy around efforts to make poverty history.
Yeah, that's beautiful, Mick. I never put this together before, but your love of Tolkien, did that flow out of like the Christian fantasy kind of stream that you're talking about in late primary school?
No, it was definitely the same time. So all of that stuff with Chronicles of Narnia, I think I found C.S. Lewis first, because in some ways his writing is just a lot more digestible. I mean, Tolkien actually sometimes writes some parts of the Bible can be hard, you know, literally to read, you know, and parts of Tolkien's writing are like that as well, in terms of it can be impenetrable. But if you stick with it, and I think as you got through, I mean, he created a whole encyclopedia, right? A whole episode. And I think once you look at the history of the mythology he created, you see a lot of those parables of what he's trying to do there and how it influenced his own faith. And of course, in they called themselves the Inklings, but they were a group, C.S. Lewis, J.R. Tolkien, and other writers that was very much motivated by their faith, but also their experience, you know, with the First and Second World War. I think many of them went into the First World War. And of course, these were Christian nations in Europe that devoured themselves. And then many of them had their own children that went to war in the Second World War as well.
Mm. Yeah, a whole nother discussion for another time. But an earlier encyclical had a profound effect on Tolkien's life. The Rerum Novarum. He self-described as a distributist.
That's right.
Which today in some circles they... I know you mentioned in your book about woke capitalism, and I was joking with Drew before we started, the traditional term for woke capitalism is socialism, but that's another discussion, because I know that's a bad word in the US. I would love to ask around what of your own experiences, and you gave people a little glimpse, the aperture opened and people got a sense of you as a university student, advocacy, organizing, putting yourself in different spaces, trips overseas, humbly learning from development, from experts on the ground for whom it's their locale, and all the expertise with knowing that this is your context, as well as those who humbly come alongside and try and take the learnings and connect it to learnings elsewhere. You've had so many experiences which has led to this place that you are now and the work you're doing now. What gifts out of what has shaped you would you offer as a lens for those who are seeking to read the Jewish and Christian scriptures in such ways that are liberating, are life-giving, are turned outwards towards others and not just fetishization around one's own personal soul? What kind of, what would you offer from your own experience for those who are seeking to engage sacred texts?
Yeah, I would say a couple of things, Jared. You know, I always describe myself as an advocate, first and foremost, as being a storyteller. I think being a great campaigner is someone who can connect with people through the power of stories. And I think there's two types of stories that are particularly powerful. The first is stories of why, because I think until you establish why you're there, your motivations, I think it's very hard to build a degree of trust and a degree of rapport. Even if you disagree on the fundamentals, say you're advocating on a specific policy and you disagree on that, you can still build a foundation of trust that you might be able to build upon from there. The second story, the type of story is stories of how, right? And I think in this day and age, it's very easy to diagnose problems, raise awareness around problems, but not anchor your advocacy in stories of solutions, because stories supply hope as well. And I guess two experiences where it might relate back, you know, to the Bible and finding ways to connect with people. You know, much has been made in advocacy, of course, in the work I do of say Bono, right? And his work launching Make Poverty History, the One campaign. And actually, Jared, I have this fond memory of you and I signing people up at his concert 15
years ago,
if you remember, and then watching it. This was in
What I remember, Mick, is that we missed Beyonce because we were signing people up to campaign, but we did get to like go out on stage with Bono and you two.
I didn't even know Beyonce was there.
That's right, right?
she was opening for Bono 15 years ago. Wow. Okay. Things have definitely changed in a big way.
That's right.
but look, much, and I think I mentioned this briefly in the book, right? Like he was trying to engage with the Bush administration and find a way to get the United States government to step up to address the HIV epidemic that was really flourishing in Africa, and unjustly so, when you had these antiretroviral drugs that could save millions of lives, where HIV no longer needed to be a death sentence. And much of, you know, the US did step up in a big way. And, you know, I think the biggest surges in development assistance came at that time. And Bono and his advocacy with evangelical Christians was credited with a lot of that and connected with values. But in terms of my own experience, where I saw this firsthand, you know, Jared, you might recall, you know, almost 10 years ago, we had the debates in Australia around marriage equality, right?
Yeah.
Which Australia is going to support. We had a big vote, a public vote in Australia. And, you know, it wasn't clear where people was going to stand. And I remember going to Parliament and having meetings with members of Parliament, you know, not necessarily about this issue, but inevitably it would come up because it was the issue of the day. And in the Labour Party in Australia, which is sort of, I guess, loosely the equivalent of the Democrats, you know, there's a huge Catholic base to that movement, right? And in many ways, you know, many of these members of Parliament, they might be economically progressive, they part of trade union movements, but socially, you know, some of the biggest people who were against marriage equality came from this side of the party, that staunch Catholic base. And one member of Parliament I remember meeting with, and he fell into this category, and he had recently changed his stance in terms of being pro marriage equality. And I asked him why, what motivated him, what led to that. And he told me how recently in his office he had had mothers come in mothers of teenage sons and daughters who had committed suicide, maybe even from the trans community, because they did not feel that their identity was validated by society, and they felt that they were made to feel less equal than others. And speaking to those mothers and connecting the value to his faith, even though he might have grappled with the question of marriage equality, he said, you know, when it comes to the value of life and the idea that all lives are created equal, I now see how marriage equality as a validation of that plays in. And he was willing to prioritize that value over his opposition and come out and support and connect that to his work. And that in many ways comes back to those questions of why and how you tell stories, and in some cases quite traumatic and hard stories and truths that need to be told, but if told in the right way, can shift people. And I think there's numerous accounts of that in the Bible. You could say that's what the Bible itself
the
is.
The Bible is, it, that's right.
Is that truth, right? Or that story that can motivate and shift people. And I guess the second story, which is a more optimistic story, which is stories of how, you know, I've been working with many advocates in the Pacific, and many of these nations are on the front lines of climate change. Many of these communities are very Christian, right? Across the, you think Fiji, you think Samoa, you know, strong Christian communities in many of these island nations. And there's this one young woman, Brianna Fruin, who I talk about in the book.
In the book, yeah.
These stories I mentioned. And Brianna has this way, and I saw her speak a few years ago, and she was talking about the climate crisis, not necessarily as needing to be the end, but as the opportunity for a rebirth of society if we get it right. And she was talking about what her community was doing in one of the nations that was on the front lines where climate change is arguably existential. And she was talking about how they're seeing this as a rebirth and a new renaissance era for humanity if we get this right. And so she was trying to motivate people by talking about what she was doing in her community and how she wasn't losing faith in her, I guess, sense of humanity being able to pull forward. And so I think that faith in humanity is itself deeply important, especially when we get into, you know, tough times like we're in right now.
Yeah, that's so good. It may be, you may be, think of, we talk about faith in humanity. Desmond Tutu has a writer where he talks about God believes in us, right?
That's right.
And this deep belief that we can, you know, we can do this, that we can lean into justice and lean into truth and lean into the healing and forgiveness. And I'm really, I loved just the emphasis as a lens, right, for entering into the scriptures, this advocating stories as well as stories of solutions. It reminds me some of work I do in Pennsylvania, working with like faith-based organizers. And a lot of times, you know, we're thinking about like, what are some of the stories, even from the scriptures themselves, right? First and foremost, that we can draw on that are parallels to, in this case, we're working on like funding for public education, but how do we bring those stories that can into faith communities that can, right, both invite them to see what's going on a little bit more in a way that where they're already valuing it, but also to invite them into the process of working to shift what's happening as well. And then, of course, centering always the stories of those who've been most impacted in the ways that they're lifting those up to invite people to be moved and shaped by the lived experiences of others. So I'm really grateful. Mm. Thank you for sharing that. I would love at this time for us with that kind of, which I can tell through our whole conversation, you've got a heart of a storyteller. can you tell us with that kind of a lens that you've kind of brought, can you lead us into a conversation around this encyclical that you've chosen, and why have you picked it? What do you think is so significant about it? Let's have a conversation around that together.
Yeah, thanks, Drew. Yeah, I think the reason why those words of the Pope really stood out to me is, you know, he talks about the fact there's society say on the climate crisis, but really many issues right now in our polarized era, people can sort of be divided into camps, right? Where you have these people on either side. And often what happens in these environments, particularly when people feel apathetic or powerlessness, is you fall into this trap of wanting to win arguments, right? And, you know, you get into debates on social media, you know, you tear down others who don't agree with your view. Like, it's horrendous. Like, I went on Twitter or X or whatever we call it these days the other night.
I'm still calling it Twitter. I don't care what it says.
You're resisting. Me too. We call it Twitter. But, you know, I was looking at some of the vitriol, and you see people literally taking what students have said on campus. You see people taking, you know, what someone may have liked a tweet, and it's almost like this, I'm putting this out there, now everyone attack, right? And the problem is, you know, this might help people feel right, righteous, certain, and safe, which is a line that came from a book called Breaking the Gridlock, which I read as part of my research for the book. But are you actually having a meaningful impact on people's lives, right?
Yeah.
You wanting to win the argument versus change society. And I think, you know, today there's many distractions, right, that can give us that short-term dopamine boost of saying, yes, okay, we've won this argument. And I think I really applaud the Pope for putting that front and center, because I see that on all sides. And you know, that self-righteousness, I think, and I talk about this in the book, is one of the biggest barriers. I talk about the concept of the
purist,
right? Where we tend to apply a purity test to all of our engagements. We say, if this idea, if this organization, if this person doesn't match 100% our view of the world, then maybe it's because out of fear of tribalism on our own tribe, being called out or being accused of being a traitor, or fearing that you would get allegations of betrayal, we kind of have this huge pressure to say, no, we're not willing to engage. We're not willing to have conversations, which is why, you know, in the book, I have these three leadership archetypes: the visionary, the implementer, and the diplomat. And in this case, you know, I highlight the diplomat, because one thing that occurred to me, and in writing the book, I interviewed numerous people who had been involved in successfully navigating policy breakthroughs, whether that was small island nations navigating debt suspension when they're hit by hurricanes, whether that was young women in South Africa fighting for access to period products, because period products are still taxed as a luxury good in many parts of the world, leading to girls to drop out of school when they hit their puberty, or whether it's trade unions and environmentalists campaigning for a world beyond coal, but trying to find common ground. Or you know, you look at conflicts like in Northern Ireland, and Jared, we've spoken about this before, and I know you've got a rich history in that part of the world. But when you look at all of these, one common trait was that it involved these discussions, and it involved a recognition that we're not necessarily going to agree on everything. And this sounds very obvious, but I kid you not, it was very hard to find sustainable policy change, right? Sustainable, lasting policy change, because you can bulldoze over people in the short term, but you can't kill ideas, right? They have a way of bouncing back. And so that is something I talk about. The good news is I also highlight many examples that are happening at a community, national, even global level that we can learn from even now if we resist some of these temptations to fall into the traps of purity tests, etc. And you know, if you give me license to just extrapolate this out, and you look at what's going on in the Middle East right now, you know, one of the things I'm conscious of is okay, well, how, you know, because many people think, well, this is a faraway conflict, I haven't been involved, you know, how does this ladder up, you know, this is very complicated. And you know, we might be also very quick to point fingers, and one thing I've kind of grappled with is my own family history in this region. And Jared knows this about, you know, back in 2012, when I was Coming up to finishing my law degree, I had the opportunity to study overseas for a semester at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And I was studying international humanitarian law, which is always very interesting in this part of the world to get people's interpretation. I think I was the only non-Jewish person in my class. And the reason why I went was because I had discovered in the lead up to that, that my grandfather, as a 16-year-old Scotsman who changed his birth certificate in the 30s so that he could sign up early to the British Army, he had actually been sent to British mandated Palestine, right? And I had come across this old photo album with all of these old photos from his time in the Holy Land. And today it was all over what would be in the West Bank, you know, he's at Fort Nablus, Bethlehem, Hebron, you know, and of course, all the way up to Haifa, Jerusalem, the old city. I had photos of him in front of the old city in Jerusalem. And it was a way to understand what happened there. And in that case, the role of the British and the role that the British play. And one thing that strikes me, you know, in the UK and other places is they might be very quick to sign up and talk about the proud role that they played with the Balfour Declaration in the birth of the State of Israel. They might also be talking about it in the context of today's conflict, you know, but never does it occur to them, actually, in many respects, in 1948, you know, the way this conflict began and the way this was created, you know, it was literally birthed. The State of Israel in 1948 was birthed in violence. So it was almost set up to have this conflict. And in many cases, you know, the British, you know, by hastily withdrawing, sowed the seeds for that. And so for me, that was incredibly humbling, especially as I learned more about what those units did in Palestine at the time in the 30s on all sides. And in many cases, it was forgotten because the victor writes history and because of the atrocities of what happened during the Second World War with the Nazis kind of drowned out any noise of what happened before. And so I look at that, and that's definitely informed, and I've written about this in various articles that people can find online, but that's informed my own approach, and I guess taking an approach of humility before kind of saying, well, I know all the answers here, and you know, I'm going to be declarative and trying to bring folks to get together. Yeah.
Mick, I've never thought of the British in that light. I appreciate you spelling it out. No, I'm just kidding. I had to have one Irish joke in there, right? Like, Mick, so much of your way of operating is marked by that humility. And I'm honestly quite moved to hear you talk about it that way, because so often people don't want to be part of a confession. They want to be part of propaganda. And for you to talk about your family's history and how holding those realities and watching you, you know, I think we met first time maybe 2011, 2012, something around there, maybe even earlier. But your ability to be more interested in the people than the issue, but care fiercely about the issue. For you not to pick a side, but always constantly be working to how do we bring everyone on side to get this done. Your way of, as a part of that, like I found myself, Drew, laughing at certain stages in the book, thinking about what Mick was doing, like with the Chogham gathering of Commonwealth countries. And I was actually being detained in on the outskirts of Jerusalem at the time while all that was going on, while I was working for. But there was a number of incidents, and even people you mentioned, like a certain Liberal Party, which is our Conservative Party, Drew, the foreign minister. She didn't like me all that much and actually took out a restraining order because of I kept getting arrested in her office. While, Mick, you were doing such important work, coming alongside, befriending, building trust. I would love to give you an opportunity to talk about what you've chosen here and the different roles instead of the one-dimensional. Could you speak a little bit to what might not be as so exciting, that behind the scenes building trust, as well as the need to provoke and other people be, you use Bill McKibben as an example for this
The
in your book.
McKibben effect. So, and it's interesting because I recently spoke about this at Columbia University, and when I had a book talk there, and it was really my major New York launch of my book, and it was actually the day when the police went in and forcibly removed the encampments at Columbia
Goodness.
University. So it was that day
Wow.
when, it was broadcast around the world. And on a funny note, I had all these people trying to get into my book talk, and one of my friend's wife, who hadn't really read the book, didn't really know me, she said, "I don't understand. Is this all because of something Michael said?" And but on a serious note, I had this panel, and one of the panelists was the ambassador of Barbados, right? And he had literally come from the Security Council the day, and I think it was the day the Security Council voted down the resolution relating to Palestinian statehood, right? And there's been many resolutions, so I forget the specifics of that one, but they had just voted down. He had come, and literally around the building, right, because of what was going on with the police, you could hear these chants, you could hear the commotion that was going on. And one thing I wanted to do was connect what was going on and say, you shouldn't look at people protesting on any issue as disconnected to advocacy that takes place in the inside, because done well, they can be complementary. And
That's
you
right.
used the McKibben effect, who I was recently with actually a few weeks ago in Vermont at Mid College, and actually went to, by the way, some of the peaceful protests taking place at the campus there. And it was very different to what was portrayed in the media and what was going on at Columbia.
Sure.
That's a whole separate issue. And the reason why I used the McKibben effect as an example is, and in the book I outline this, is I do believe sometimes, I talk about this concept of the Overton window, right? So what policies are socially and politically acceptable at any one given time? And I do believe that by advocating for what might be perceived as extreme or radical positions, right, can shift the conversation, can shift the terms of the dialogue that society is having, and can shift that window along. And in the context of the environmental movement, Bill McKibben and his divestment campaign, calling for universities and other institutions to divest from fossil fuel in investment, has in large part been credited with shifting the conversation from one of, does climate change exist, or should we be taking action on climate change, to a question of how should we be taking action on climate change? And it's created the space for, I suppose, more moderate campaigners pushing solutions like clean energy, renewable energy subsidies to enter the debate and forge, in many cases, a bipartisan consensus that's resulted in real policy breakthroughs and real wins. So this, of course, is an example of where it working well. One area is, of course, the pitfalls. And one risk that I talk about in the book is when those pushing on the extreme margins, might feel the need, and by the way, this goes both ways, to attack or call out those who are considered more moderate, right, or not advocating the same extreme positions. And when this happens, what happens is it can actually tank the whole movement as a
Movement,
whole
that's right.
and alienate people. And it's where then the movement disintegrates into a question or a debate on who is more pure, who is more righteous. And you certainly have seen that play out over the years in different aspects of the environmental movement. But at its best, and I interviewed many of the people involved in the breakthrough of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the most successful climate legislation, or comprehensive pass to date in the US. It does have its flaws, it has its shortfalls, it has its gaps, but it also, was a significant breakthrough. And many of the campaigners involved was almost recognizing that they had fallen into this trap in the past, and how do they not let the opportunity slip through their fingers again when it was presented to them, you know, a decade
and that was an incredibly broad coalition.
Yeah.
Like inspiringly so.
Yeah. Yeah. And it involved bringing people together, like economic, racial discrimination and advocates in the South, some groups who had never campaigned on environmental issues before. And it was really building these synergies. And, you know, it was funny, one of the campaigners I interviewed said, you know, we got some of the, even the crazy left-leaning ones, we got some of the conservative groups over here that only talk about conservation, not climate change. And I said, dude, and he said, we organize sleepovers, we organize retreats. And then he said, the coolest thing is when the next opportunity arose, we walked up to Washington with the most diverse, broad environmental movement ever assembled in the history of the US.
Yeah.
Yeah. Incredible.
That's good. That's good. Yeah. And you're making me think about just the whole conversation. I was thinking about some interactions with some students and, I guess you were talking about, like, you know, there's this impulse of being self-righteous and the purity and all these things, and sometimes missing, like, let me go backwards a little bit. There's a part of me, I'm grounded in the Black radical prophetic tradition in many ways, also Anabaptism in many ways. Both of those can have very strong visions for our worlds in really powerful and beautiful ways that orients me and shape my imagination for who I want to be and what I'm hoping for, right? I call it God's dream for us, right, in creation. And at the same time, ironically, I think most Black Christians have a very pragmatic orientation in many ways because of what is actually possible, right? Mm-hmm. That also is held in tension, that is a part of how I think about how I live and move. And I try to hold both of those things simultaneously, right? So that I can both speak and talk about abolition sometimes when needed, right? And also, and how do we begin to take a step in the right direction given who we are and where we're at right now, right? Mm. So maybe it's a little bit of marrying all these things, not even as separate characters, but also like holding that in my own body. But I was thinking about some of my students who their first impulse is like, you know, we're going to protest the campus, which is good. Like in some ways, like I get excited, right? I won't lie. I'm like, anytime students want to protest, I'm like, I got your back. However, there's also like, can we have a conversation, right? Do we start with us versus them, or can we have a conversation with those? And some of them have access, are in roles within the university that have access where they're not even taking the opportunity to have conversations, to meet people, to see where they're at, to see if there's opportunities. Anyway, I just think that reimagining on a whole bunch of different levels, you know, the different opportunities and ways that we can actually seek change is really important. So I really appreciate all that you're saying. I'm coming from a different angle, but I'm thinking about all of that, and I think it's really meaningful and substantive.
But I don't think it needs to be mutually exclusive. To your point, right, on acts of protest and conversation, you know, I mentioned being at Middlebury College in Vermont, and I went out and spoke to some of the student leaders at one of the encampments there. And, you know, it was an incredible conversation. And I asked him about the dialogue, and he said, you know, it's been very productive. He said, look, on the one hand, we students, we haven't damaged student property. We haven't done anything. The only thing we've done is literally, you could argue, we're trespassing by setting up our tents on the common green. But other than that, we're not, you know, occupying buildings. We're not doing anything. That our conversations with the administration has been incredibly productive. And it was interesting, I actually asked him this, and I didn't know the background of this student leader. I literally just went up, we were talking to him, just met him. But I asked him, I said, and you know, there's been reports of Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. I said, you know, do students of different faiths, do they feel safe here on campus? Because I've heard that increasingly, and I've met other students, particularly here in New York, who have spoken about feelings of safety. And he said, thanks for asking. And he revealed to me that he was actually Jewish. And when these encampments first arose on campus, he was actually hesitant and his parents didn't want him getting involved. And it was through the conversations and the dialogues.
Yeah.
And then only did he say, okay, this is something I want to be a part of, but actually arose up and became one of the leaders over an incredibly short period of time. I mean, you're probably speaking, you know, not even a matter of months, maybe weeks. And I thought, wow, this is a great example of actually a movement trying to bring people in through the power of dialogue, conversation. Mm-hmm. And it's something which we don't see necessarily in the media headlines.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yep, that's good.
Yeah, same, you'll be encouraged on Whadjuk Noongar land where we've grown up, Mick. At Curtin University, the encampments there, Jews for Palestine have been present and involved in my few trips out there, only three. Amazing atmosphere, but totally not what came across in the media. It wasn't what people were seeing. But I think there is, and unsurprisingly, Mick, that both for me and the fact that, you know, you're on a podcast with God Botherers, we're probably going to bring it back to our guy, right? And the example of Jesus is he is consistently transgressive in who he hangs out with.
Yeah.
In terms of this like kingdom movement building that he is doing through Galilee all the way as he sets his face like flint towards Jerusalem, is there is a transgressive sense of those who are interested in a political and religious purity. He messes with them by who he eats with, who he invites to partner with, and it's not a peacekeeping that like, oh, let's play nice and not raise issues, but it's like, actually, how can you be involved in this different way of doing something that is this radical presence of compassion
mm-hmm.
paired uncompromisingly with confrontation. And I think they're the parts of the movement that maybe you and I and our friendships in really interesting ways kind of have sat in on different sides. And people might be surprised that are like, oh, was Mick hanging out in his more radical days with Jared? Or was Jared like more playing within the system and has since realized that things are so dire that he's gone more extreme or something like that? And it's like, no, not at all. We just have an understanding of how change actually works and that we actually need each other in the movement and that we can only succeed together.
That's right. But I do remember, and I want to mention this because one of my first very substantive discussions with you, Jared. So we were, Drew, for your benefit, we were doing this Make Poverty History campaign, and this was 2010. And we were taking hundreds of young people from across the country to Canberra, capital of Australia, to meet with their local members of parliament to advocate for Australia increasing its foreign aid development assistance to help, you know, countries living in vulnerable situations around the world. And, you know, I think it was about 1,000 people, and Jared came on board as a mentor, and we were sat next to each other. I think it was on the bus from Sydney to Canberra. So several hours sat next to one another. And Jared said to me, you know, something which I've always remembered. He said, there's a lot of people I've worked with in my activism that would be shocked that I'm here now with you, because they would look at this kind of mainstream going out, getting young people involved, you know, getting companies involved, getting musicians involved, and they would say, okay, is this activism light, right? Or is this the Disneyfication of activism? Because you're getting young people involved for, you know, a short period of time. You're saying, come to Canberra, share your stories, but you're saying you can do this alongside all your other interests, right? And I asked you, I said, well, what do you mean by different shades of activism? Because this was my experience, of course. And I remember, Jared, you pulled out your notepad and you wrote up those four quadrants, and you walked me through them. And you know,
it's so boring that I continue to do the same stuff with people all around the world continually. Like, but Bill Moyers, it's the four paradigms of change. So there's the rebel, the citizen, the change agent, and the reformer. There we go.
That was right. That was right. And you pinpointed, and I remember you put, I think it was Martin Luther King in the reformer, and you said, I asked you where you thought my activism and, you know, broadly what was doing fit. And you said, this is here in the reformer. But you put it in its context. And I think that was a different way of expressing what we was talking about before, how all of these different shades of activism, I suppose, when they work well, can work together. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. And Mick, I think the importance of you even mentioning that is, like, King was on a journey. Our brother Martin,
right,
was on a journey like all of us. And yeah, many people are very critical of his I Have a Dream speech and this kind of, like, T-shirts, this isn't your grandma's movement kind of take on stuff, not realizing that grandma might be far more radical on a bunch of stuff than you actually realize.
Giving credit for, right. That's right.
And the criticism of King's I Have a Dream speech and not connecting it to the policies that were passed a year later is right, a failure to actually read that movement, that moment, and what was needed in the movement. Right. And when King, towards the end of his life, talks about the nightmare, he's not moving away that was necessary then. Yeah. It's making sure that people don't contain his whole analysis in that moment.
Right.
Exactly. Well said.
Good.
Mick, this has been a joy, mate. I finished your book and then listened to the whole thing again, back to back. I thought it was fantastic. I've already sent it to a bunch of people. I was telling Drew that this is going to be a great resource. So thankful for your time, mate. I think we should do a sequel where we go from ideas to impact and where we go the soul of impact. I would like to do something on the spirituality of impact and how we actually hold these different. There's so many parts in the book where I'm like, yes, this, but let's do, like, personal growth as movement growth. So we'll chat some more. But, mate, congratulations. This is phenomenal.
Well,
so thankful for you. And so thankful that you've distilled, like, all these years of this incredible work into something that isn't merely a memoir, but is much more a roadmap for how anybody can get involved that's never been involved before. And that's beautiful.
Yeah, no, I really want to thank you. And there's lots more threads, and even Drew, what you were talking about, you know, in terms of Black activists in America and grappling with that pragmatism. You know, one of the great leaders I got to work with was Prime Minister Mia Motley in Barbados. And of course, in there, her activism often grapples with the legacy of colonialism and slavery, but also how is she going to convince people and say the United Kingdom and citizens to get on board? So there's a lot there we can also unpack, but I think in many ways that does actually relate to, you know, soul and impact, Jared. So yeah, would be open to that, but really, really want to thank you both for this great conversation and a different way to talk about the eight steps of the book, because the whole point is it should be digestible, relatable to all. And, you know, I wasn't intending to write Shakespeare or anything like that. I know it doesn't have all the answers, but as I said, I hope it gives many people a place to begin and a place to get started.
Awesome. Well, thanks for the resource and thank you. Great having a great conversation with you.
Thank
friends,
you,
we'll link in the show notes where you can access Mick's book. And for those that are joining us live, we have an opportunity to ask a few questions of Mick before he has to nick off. If you would like to be a part of those live conversations, please remember the Patreon. It's set up in such a way that people from lots of different economic backgrounds can participate without losing out, thanks to the kindness of others who believe in this community. Let's keep journeying together.
The Inverse podcast is proudly supported by you, the listener. And if you want to join the revolutionaries who are helping us have conversations about how this ancient text can still turn the world upside down, why don't you head over to patreon.com/inverse.